Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Scotland, episode number 5, Foundations. Last time, we heard about the arrival of the Picts, which is one of those almost iconic subjects, if I can use that much overused word. Why is everything iconic these days? Anyway, there will of course be much more chance for discussion about Picts and the questions they raise, but now, ladies and gentlemen, there are more well-known players to bring to the stage. Last time I gave a sort of traditional framework of the different peoples who are supposed to make up the Scotland that will emerge in the end. Today, let's talk about them. The Kingdom of Dalriada, the Gaels, the Britons of Out Clut. You might well feel the need for maps, by the way, and there will duly be a map on the Tinternet at the History of England website, .co.uk, all that sort of thing. But before all that, last time we left with the barbarian conspiracy of 367, with years of mayhem, murder and destruction. For the Romano-British inhabitants, used to centuries of peace, wicker baskets, the period must have been remarkably hideous, fire and sword visited on them as the Picti and Scotty kiddies were released into the sweet shop. Within 50 years, the Roman Empire would be gone from Britain. Initially, at least, it seemed that the normal order of things had reasserted itself, and would do so again in the future, no doubt. Restoring order didn't prove trivial, mind. The Romans didn't just wander in, flutter a couple of eagles around, and all the Picti and Scotties scuttle back over the wall. Two commanders, Severus and Jovinus, arrived, couldn't handle the situation, and asked for reinforcements. And so eventually, Flavius Theodosius was sent. Theodosius slowly re-established order. He campaigned against the invaders, he offered amnesties to deserters from the Roman army, he could replace the Count of the Saxon Shore and the Dux Britanniarum. It did his career no end of good, though it didn't end well for him personally. But his son would become emperor. During the process of re-establishing order, it looks as though Theodosius may have been pretty creative about his approach. Now I have this vague impression that rebellions and invasions were always put down. The phrase put down has always seen a rather odd one of a heavily booted Roman soldier sort of pushing a hairy native's face into a patch of mud. But it looks as though Theodosius enlisted the help and support of the natives too. So there are reports of the mysterious Anacotti, who were part of the invaders, serving with Roman armies on the continent, which suggests he offered them a deal, and it may well be that he offered a sort of deal to the Scotti and Picti as well. He also worked with the more enthusiastic Romanisers among the tribes of northern Britain, notably the Wotidini, and he used them to help repress disorder, and he gave them some sort of role in the new regime. Those Wotidini are seriously beginning to look like the teacher's pet, and we all know what happens to the teacher's pet if the teacher leaves the classroom, do we not? About which, more later. Because the Roman teacher was eventually going to be forced to leave the classroom for good, hate it or loathe it. For all his successes, Count Theodosius was unable to fix the fundamental problems of the empire, even in Britain. And the systems of defence look as though they were never fully restored. One of the commanders at Theodosius' side was one Magnus Maximus. I think it unlikely that Magnus Maximus pounced around declaring, "My name is Maximus, commander of the armies of the north, general of the Felix legions, loyal servant to the true emperor Marcus Aurelius, father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife, and I will have my vengeance in this life or the next." But it's not impossible, I guess. Though this is, of course, a completely different Maximus, but it gave me a chance to pretend to be Russell Crowe. Magnus Maximus was a naughty boy through and through, no mistake. The trouble in Britain clearly continued, since Magnus Maximus was back in Britain in 383 when he was overcome with naughtiness and launched his usurpation attempt on the Roman Emperor from Britain, taking a bunch of troops back with him. So it was as Augustus in the West that he was then forced to return to Britain again. Genuine peace was still not restored, raids still troubled the province. I like the idea, incidentally, of splitting up the territory of the empire. It was Diocletian, wasn't it, who had the idea of two Augustuses and two Caesars. I thought I might make myself Augustus of the Sheds of the North or something like that. Dylan the Dog could be Dux Hortensius in charge of poo creation, something for which he has something of a talent. Just a thought. Anyway, Magnus Maximus, commander of the armies of the north, father to an acnid son and so on, was not finished with Britain. He had to return in 384. The Gallic Chronicle records that Maximus vigorously overcame the invading Picti and Scoti. In 1985, in a German village, a late Roman artifact was discovered. It was a dice tower. The idea of dice towers was that some of your companions might be very clever at throwing dice, and for want of a more sympathetic word, they might be cheating tinkers. So, what you do is you chuck the dice in the top of the tower, they come out through a space at the bottom, and everyone is happy. This particular dice tower bears an inscription, Pictos Victos Hostis Delita Ludite Securi, which means loosely, we've given the Picts a kicking, we've rubbed them out, so play in peace. It's entirely possible that this refers to Maximus's campaigns. But even this was to be a temporary success. Maximus had quite a position in British legend. None of this is really historical, but it maybe tells us something about the way the Roman Empire ended in Britain, famously completed by 410, of course. In one legend, Maximus married a Welsh princess. Another legend was that he gave a British queen sovereignty over all Britain. He appears in Welsh genealogies as the founder of dynasties. Gildas himself accuses Maximus of basically stripping Britain of all its soldiers and men of talent, and then handing over responsibility to the local tribes, essentially leaving and shutting the door firmly behind him. This is probably not the way it happened. The Romans expected to be back. And it might be that Stilicho did actually come back around 400 for a further campaign. But maybe there is a kernel of truth. Part of both Theodosius and Maximus's campaigns seems to have tied in and enlisted the help of the Romanising tribes on the border, as we've said. We've mentioned the Wotodini, but there are others. The Damnoni along the 4th Clyde line, the Novanti in the southwest of Galloway, where it might be expected the Scotty raiders would appear from Ireland. Either way, hate it or loathe it, by 410 no further help would come from Rome. Which is categorically not to say that the Romano-British did not hope or even expect that it would come. After all, it always had before. But in the future, they were to be unfailingly disappointed. So I believe I may have mentioned that this is the Dark Ages, and things are really dark. Let me know if I haven't mentioned that recently. Well, nothing that isn't actually a warping of the space-time continuum could be darker than the 4th and 5th centuries in Scotland. For the areas north of Hadrian's Wall, the impact of the withdrawal of Rome must have been considerably less dramatic than elsewhere in Roman Britannia. But nonetheless, as we've seen in the last few episodes, it did have an impact. To some degree, the peoples north of the 4th Clyde line had allied with each other to oppose the common Roman enemy after the collapse of the Severan system of the 3rd century. From this had come the idea of Pictland, which in the 4th century was no doubt a rather decentralised structure, but nonetheless it was one where kings and state structures were beginning to make a halting appearance. Now as the Roman threat disappeared, there must have been some effect. As the old enemy left the stage of history, their absence must have had an impact on the groupings that appeared in their wake. So let us now explore what those groupings might have begun to look like. We noted how Pictland saw the hardening of society into more formal elites, accompanied by a warrior class to support them. This must have been a very variable process, depending on where you happen to be. This is a period, for example, where Outer and Inner Hebrides, for example, doesn't seem to have been particularly politically or culturally influential. That's a terribly dismissive phrase, isn't it? Almost as though I were describing modern Loughborough. Sorry, didn't mean to be insulting, Inner and Outer Hebrides, but that seems to be the way it is. There's no room for sentiment in history. Out here, the more fluid, socially flatter farmer republics may well have survived longer and later. Even in Pictland, there would have been hierarchies and, as one historian put it, relativities of kingship. You might call yourself king and yet be a pimple on the buttock of another more powerful king. The Irish had three levels of king, sub-kings, kings, high kings. It might well be that many parts of northern Britain followed this very same model. Our old irritable and bile-spouting friend Gildas was uncomplimentary about the whole lot of them. Wandering thieves, he said, who had no taste for war, who were in perfect accord with their greed for bloodshed. But Gildas was an unhappy man. My mother would have guessed at constipation or something like that, and so he was an unreliable commentator. Nonetheless, around the concept of kingship, physical territory began to appear. since these were those areas where kings could extend their protection to. And although the textual resources are so horribly light, there is a sort of impression of an outline left on the page of history, like undulations in the sand after a spot of sunbathing. Over the period, new kingdoms appeared to sit along those that survived and remained. One is a Brittonic kingdom of Reged. This is a kingdom we hear about first through Welsh poems. I'm told that using a Welsh poem as a historical source is something to be done very carefully, that as you do it, you need to be in a place where salt is freely available. This rings true to me. Let me visualise a warm Lord's Hall in the hills and valleys of Wales, with the winter weather howling outside and the fire filling the hall with smoke. The Lord calls on his bard for a song about the glorious British kingdoms of old. And I find it difficult to visualise a bard shaking his head firmly and making it clear that he really couldn't possibly, since the facts are not yet clearly established. He'd sing them a good story, would he not? And the children would gather in closely. They don't need to be bothered with historical accuracy. Nonetheless, the very bare bones seem to be verifiable. It's reasonably certain that by the late 5th century, a British kingdom called Reged did come into being in what is now northern England and probably into southwestern Scotland. Its extent is very difficult to be clear about. In what we had called Outer Brigantia, southeast Scotland, modern Lothian, the Wotidini remained, although their name had become the Godothin. To the uninitiated, this sounds odd, but the professionals seem to nod wisely and point to various vowel shifts and all the rest of it. Nonetheless, our Romanising friends do appear to have abandoned the mighty hill fort of Traphraine Law by the end of the 5th century. Which is a shame for Traphraine Law and all, but good news for the future of festivals and shopping, because the new HQ was very probably a place called Dyn Edin, one day to be called Edinburgh. Now, I haven't been to every city in the world or anything like it, but there can't be many that can compare for interest and beauty as does Edinburgh. I had my first official job interview there, you might like to know, and that led to one of the most agonising days of my life. It's not entirely clear whether Godothin first set up shop, maybe Castle Rock, or maybe Arthur's Seat. But from now on, Edinburgh will become a growing part of our story. From Edinburgh, the Godothin controlled Lothian, a patch of southeastern Scotland. It's also quite possible that the southern Wotidini carved out the kingdom of Bernicia in what is now northeastern England, Northumbria. Now, I suspect you might cock an ear at this point. Oi, you might say, have we wandered into the history of Anglo-Saxon England or what? Bernicia will become known as the home of the Angles, of course, will be twinned with Deira to become Northumbria, but not yet, my friends, not yet. Many of the names of the centres of English Bernicia have British roots. Bamburgh, for example, and indeed Bernicia itself. And in these days of the 5th and early 6th century, it could indeed have been ruled by the Godothin, a British kingdom. Another of the British tribes of Outer Brigantia, also continued into the 5th century, the Domnoni, had probably inhabited territory north and south of the 4th Clyde line, and they began to inhabit a kingdom that was based at a place called Out Clut, or the Rock of the Clyde. This is modern Dumbarton Rock, a volcanic outcrop on the River Clyde, which offered the Domnoni a base from which to raid and rule, quite possibly including the area previously inhabited by the Maiatai, north of the River Tay. Just to jump ahead, Out Clut will become the heart of a later kingdom called Strathclyde, a Brittonic kingdom with its own language stretching down into Cumbria, northwest England. But at this time, Out Clut probably looked east rather than south, along a central belt along the Clyde Forth line. In southern and central Scotland, the Godothin and Out Clut could slug it out. There seems to be more than a suggestion that at one point it is one of the Godothin who rules as a king at Out Clut, for example. Last time, we described a Pictland that was clearly a very decentralised kingdom, which saw itself and was seen by others as one people, but with very significant divisions within it. While the Seven Regions of the Seven Brothers is dismissed as historical fiction these days, it reflects at least that in many places and many times, power was very local indeed, and leadership moved from place to place. The most important division in Pictland was again that of the high ridge of mountains in the Grampians called the Munth. And once again, there are maps on the website to use and refer to if you can make it there. Now into Pictland comes another name, that of Fortrue. Oh goody, I hear you say, oh goody, a new name. There are so many, I am sorry, but this will be with us for a while if it's of any comfort. To start with the nomenclature, to get that right, Fortrue is the place. It is itself within Pictland. The people who inhabit that region we shall refer to in the future as Vertruarians. There's been a long and hard debate through the years about where Fortrue actually was. For many years, until reasonably recently, it was thought to be located in southern Pictland. This is one of those many revisions that we've had over the last 10 years, because now the consensus is that Fortrue was north of the Moonth, along the Murray Firth, and therefore very much in northern Pictland. This ties in with the ancient Pictish fort of Burghead. It's clear that the Picts had great expertise at sea, and Burghead seems to have been a centre of shipbuilding. Yet another debate about the Picts is the idea of a Pictish navy, at once declared by somebody to be absolutely certain, and then by others to be utter hogwash. This is a debate into which I will not get stuck, largely since I have no insights to contribute. But for my part, a large state-controlled and organised organisation implied by the word navy seems most unlikely at this time. But nonetheless, there seems to be some evidence that, navy or not, the Pictish kings could at least call on significant expertise at sea, although based on boats much smaller than the later Viking ships, so they had maybe 20 seats on average. It seems that it was Fortrue where the seat of Pictland resided. From there, the hegemony of those early Pictish kings began to extend southwards into the area south of the Moonth, to where it came up against the territories of the inheritors of the Maetai and the Dumnoni, the kingdom of Outclut. It used to be that tracing the outlines of Pictland was considered relatively straightforward, although impossible to put a time to its expansion. This was because there were markers, the Pictish stones, for example, with their handy divisions into class 1 and 2, could also give a rough idea of earlier and later expansion. For those of you who haven't been to the website, class 1 were stones without any kind of Christian symbolism. Class 2 is where Christian symbolism was combined with the old Pictish symbols. There was also the delight of place names, always a favourite topic. It's in place names that hints of the pre-Celtic lost Pictish language remain. Some of these were almost certainly signs of Pictish settlement. So the prefix Abba, for example, means river mouth. So, as in Aberdeen. Abernethy on the Firth of Tay is another example. Other prefixes derived from the Pictish are lanach, or a clearing, and doll, or meadow. But the big one was the Pictish word pet, which appears in place names as the prefix pit. It means an estate or a parcel of land or a place, and they're really common in eastern and northeastern Scotland, and therefore they seem to describe for us perfectly the outline of Pictland. But the trouble with them, in fact, is that they're almost always twinned with a suffix which is Gaelic in character, Goidelic Celtic. An example might be Pittenweem in Fife. Pittenweem seems to be a combination of the Pictish pit and a Gaelic word for caves, so the place of caves. So it seems that pit place names like Pittenweem were unlikely to have been created by the Picts in the 3rd to 9th centuries. Instead, it looks as though they were created later, 9th to 11th centuries, as the Gaelic culture began to dominate in the kingdom of Alba, or Scotland. Gaelic incomers may have taken the Pictish word they met when they arrived, and then added a word that they understood, like caves in the Pittenweem example. So it's not quite so certain that a pit name was actually created by the Picts at this early period, though it's a reasonable indicator that there was a Pictish settlement there originally. The latest theory is that they were often ecclesiastical estates which were sublet to arriving Gaelic warriors. But what the distribution of stones and pit names indicates is a heavy settlement all over eastern Scotland, down as far as and including Fife, but with very little settlement in Lothian or Atlantic Scotland, or indeed Argyll. We will debate whether or not Argyll was Pictish in a little while, but there is the odd Pictish place name in northwestern Scotland, so probably the Pictish kingdoms extended thus far and into the Northern Isles. The point to focus on, I guess, is this division between North and South Pictland. North of the Mounth, or south of the Mounth into Angus and even Fife. If you don't recognise the word Mounth, this is, after advice from a Scot, what I shall now be calling the physical feature previously known as the Moonth. Sorry about that. The division between North and South Pictland will be with us for many a year. Sometimes a single king will yield authority over both, and sometimes they won't. The Pictish Chronicles give us this slightly spurious list of the names of kings, into which I plan not to go very much. However, it's interesting that son almost never follows father. It's much more commonly the brother. Also, we know that some Pictish kings seem to rule elsewhere, in Outclut, for example. There seems to be a fluidity of descent and inheritance. Together, they seem to rather support a suggestion in Bede that the Picts had an exceptional practice of inheritance through the female rather than the male line. And after all, we know Bede, he's an authoritative source, not the sort of borderline madman like Gildas. This is what the venerable old codger had to say for himself. As the Picts had no wives, they asked the Scotty for some. The latter consented to give them women only on condition that, in all cases of doubt, they should elect their king from the female royal line rather than the male. And it is well known that the custom has been observed amongst the Picts to this day. Now, this one's got everyone proper blazing. For one thing, it's pretty exceptional, so it feeds that enigmatic Pict thing. But also, there are some that kind of assumed that matriliny, i.e. descent through the female line, equaled matriarchal, a matriarchal society, and that the Picts were therefore some kind of shining example of a modern, enlightened society. It was all terribly exciting. Of course, it was all bound to end in tears, and it has done. Some bright spark, probably many bright sparks, actually pointed out that matriliny most definitely did not indicate a matriarchal society, and in fact might mean the very opposite. And more recently, the historians have gone to town and now appear to agree that even matriliny is a chimera. To start with, it's worth noting that Bede has swallowed the myth that the Picts come from Scythia, which says nothing for historical chops, but let's put that to one side. The absolutely exceptional nature of matriliny is the first argument against it. It just doesn't seem to happen anywhere else in Europe. It seems most unlikely. No other source refers to it. Pictish kings are referred to as sons of their fathers, which would be odd if it was a matrilinear descent that mattered. They'd surely refer to their mothers instead. However, the debate does leave us a couple of points to consider. What does appear to happen is that in exceptional circumstances, then the female line might be taken into account, which does tie back into Bede's account. Plus, we have to explain the lack of sons in the earlier Pictish king list somehow. It could be that a brother is just a better bet, older, more experienced. Though the line has to move through the generations at some point. But it could also be that eligibility for kingship is still pretty fluid, that kings could be chosen from outside one particular dynasty. And it would explain why at one point a Gael is known to be a king of the Picts. In an attack by the Godothin on Catterick in Yorkshire, they appear to be led by an Angle. Okay, back to the tour of early historic Scotland then. So we had the Brittonic Pictland dominating most of Scotland north of the River Tay. We have Brittonic descendants of the tribes the Romans knew, though gently changing their identities. The Wotidini have become the Godothin and Lothian, and maybe possibly perhaps even Bernicia. The Damnonian, or Brittonic counterparts of the Damnoni, are inhabiting Altclut in the west on the River Clyde, and over the central belt to Manaw, the area north of the Tay where the Maiatai came from. So where, I hear you ask? Where are the Gaels? Where are the Goidelic Celts? And therein lies a story, and it is the story of foundation myths. So here's a thing about what we increasingly seem to be calling pseudo-history, which to read, fun history. What we know about the period comes from archaeology, which as we know is a bit rubbish for chronology and politics, and from texts from hundreds of years after the 4th and 5th centuries. By which time, They have many different reasons for writing the Chronicles. No one really wants to say, look, our kingdom was descended from some loser who got lucky one day. Or that's to say, they didn't like to say that back then, maybe they would now. No, they wanted to be descended from a mighty warrior, hung like a baboon, or maybe from a deeply holy man, or maybe better, from God. So people sort of made things up, or at least extrapolated from spurious wishful thinking, and before you know it, you have a glorious history which proves far more attractive than the rather messy truth. As James Fraser puts it rather nicely, I thought, medieval origin stories and genealogies were steeped in political significance, not historical accuracy. In the case of the Gaels, we seem to have a few stories, though there is one thing that they do all agree on, which is where in Scotland the Gaels started to appear, and this is in a place called Argyll. For those of you who don't know it, we're talking sort of north of the Clyde on the western Atlantic seaboard, a land of islands and peninsulas, Islay, Jura, Kintyre. This is the area that by whatever means and process, the Gaels will make their home. So, let's have a few theories then. The bloke nearest to the events we're talking about was our Gildas, sometimes called Gildas the Wise, though I suspect at the time some of the younger monks probably called him Gildas the Grumpy. He was writing in the 6th century, so surely had the best chance of knowing, surely. His view was the wiggly worm and coracle's one. By the way, I'm assuming you know what a coracle is. It's a very small boat, bit like a wicker basket, often just for one person. Don't ever go in one is my advice. Instant death as far as I can see. Step in, over you go, wham bam, thank you San. Though, apparently they are in fact pretty unsinkable. Still, how you get one over 18 miles of seawater fails me. Anyway, his theory is the wiggly worm one, where two bunches of people come over, the Picts and the Gaels, though he calls the Gaels Scotty, and you can see where that will lead at some point in the future. They come over at the same time, so the Gaels take up home in Argyll, and the Picts everywhere else, presumably. Fair enough. Then there's Bede, who's got far better historical chops. He's 8th century, remember. Bede's story is that it's the Irish who come over. The Irish take a fancy to a bit of Pict land, and that's why they nip over. Here's what he actually says. Under the leader Roider, and one among the Picts, either by league or by iron, the seats that they still possess. From this leader, they are still called Dalroidini, for in their language Dal signifies apart. So you have the origin of the name Dalriada, the name you probably recognise for the Gaelic kingdom, part of the people of Roider. Anyway, that's the story. They're Irish, the land properly belonged to the Picts, but they whipped it. He even places them in southern Argyll, the part of the kingdom that would be home to the Corcu Raiti. The what, I hear you ask. Corcu is an Irish language word for kindred. So the Corcu Raiti are essentially the kingdom of Raiti, and we assume that Raiti means Roider. So, the kindred of Roider. I have to say that trying to unravel all of this is almost unbelievably complicated without being an expert. But there was another tradition, which most people would probably recognise far more quickly than the Bede tradition. This is the legendary Fergus Moore, Fergus the Great. The legend comes from a number of different sources. There is a Gaelic tract called The Four Principal Kindred of Dalriada. There is the 10th century, The History of the Men of Scotland, the Sentius as it's known, and there's also something called The Song of the Scots of the 12th century. So the story is that Fergus was an Irish king, who came over with his sons. Depending which texts and genealogies you accept, these established three or four kindreds in Dalriada, based in different places in Argyll. One was descended from Lorne the Great, and became the Cenel Lorne in North and Mid Argyll. Cenel, as far as an Englishman can work out, appears to be similar to Corcu, but maybe with a greater connotation of nation rather than simply kindred. Then there's Oinius, and therefore the associated people, the Cenel Ninusa, who lived on the Isle of Islay. There is the Cenel Navarrain in Kintyre, and finally the Cenel Coviail, based in East Argyll, who gave their name to the district of Cowell. There are maps, gentle listeners, there are maps you know where. Also, look, I'm trying to pronounce these names as well as I can. Written down, all those names to be appear, the Cenel Oingusa, the Canal Ngabrain, and the Canal Comgale. But look, I thought I'd try and do it right, probably to the greater confusion of both you and me, but let us together reach up to the stars, climb every mountain higher, in the words of a nameless pop group my kid is used to dance to when small and cute. I can still do the dance, by the way. Actually, it's a good deal more complicated than that, with the odd Dominyart and Corgu wandering around, but that's the guts of it. What you should take away from this is that there is much less emphasis in this tradition that one of the kindred was the dominant force, as for the Corgu Reiti in Bede's story. That there was always a kind of parity among the different peoples, albeit from time to time one of the kings would acquire a certain preeminence. That there was from the start a sort of unity about a kingdom called Dalriata. But the same origin is assumed as the other stories. The Gaels came from Ireland. The Scots are in fact Irish. Right, so what are we all to make of this? What's the view from the modern day proper historian, and what can an improper historian, such as those that live in sheds, relate to you? Bede's story and the other information Bede gives us about Scotland gives a pretty clear indication that Bede had met a Pict. The Pict had told him a bunch of stuff. Note bene that his version of the Gaels has it that this land was owned originally by the Picts, with a pretty clear indication that the Picts might jolly well decide to have it back at some point, thank you very much. As far as archaeology is concerned, there is no evidence that the Roman Iron Age saw a migration to Scotland from Ireland by a single Irish people. There is absolutely zip by way of any sign of an interruption or dramatic change in culture which might explain such a thing. This has caused the whole idea to be called into question. Added to this is the revolution in the way texts are read by historians these days, the recognition that the texts we are using reflect the political realities of their day. So, one principal source, for example, is the Life of St. Columba, written by the abbot of the monastery of Iona, founded by said St. Columba from Ireland. It is surprising that its author, Admonam, favours the role of the Canal Lorne, in whose territory Iona lay. At the time the Four Principal Kindred tract was written, it was also true that the Dalriata was dominated by the Canal Lorne, but also that Dalriata had indeed acquired a level of political unity. And therefore, it's unsurprising that the history they produced also projected that unity onto the 5th and early 6th centuries, which could be hogwash, and indeed is likely to be the washing of hogs. The idea of mass migrations for both Picti and Scotti, as related by Gildas in 540, has been firmly rejected again on the grounds of archaeology. Really, all we can take firmly from Gildas is that by the time he was writing around 540, the Gaels and Dalriata were firmly established in Argyll. The thing that all these traditions seem to agree on is that the Dalriadans came from Ireland. It's also worth noting that they spoke a different language. I think you all know this, we've referred to it before many times, but just to make sure it's clear. They're still a Celtic people with a Celtic language, but the form of Celtic they speak is not Brittonic, which is what the Picts speak. It is Goidelic, Q-Celtic as it's known. The difference in language also seems to reinforce the idea that this is an Irish invasion. And yet, modern historians are in something of a pother about that whole thing as well. Nobody likes the idea of mass migrations and genocide anywhere anymore. The idea of acculturalisation and gradual movements is simply much more believable. Plus, there is just this lack of supporting archaeological evidence for any kind of mass movement. One theory, then, is of a sort of circular migration. In the words of Christy Murr, we go there and they come here. Anyone for the last few chalk ices now. The idea builds on the fact that we should not see the Irish Sea as a divider, but as a connector. To make again the point I made a few episodes ago, that in the centuries before reliable roads, the sea on a good day was a darn sight easier to navigate for a 15-mile stretch than a similar distance of land. Some of the maps I've seen follow the really simple technique of simply turning a map of northeast Ireland and southwest Scotland on its side, with west as up rather than north. It completely changes your perspective, and it makes you realise that these two things are really, really close. So the theory says that if you think of Ireland and Argyll as one, forget modern political divisions, forget the division of the sea, the idea of who was where first all becomes a bit irrelevant. Equally, there's a school of thought that says that the evidence points to a different emphasis on circular migration. That yes, it's circular, back and forth, it's gradual, bit by bit. But actually, it starts with migrations in Scotland, in Argyll, which go over to Ireland. And the migration back from Ireland comes later. Let's finish with this one, so here we go. The early Roman surveys of northern Britain call the inhabitants of Kintyre, the peninsula within Argyll, as the Epidae, in a context that is very much of a Brittonic people. Epidae means horsemen. The theme of horsemen runs throughout the languages. So the Gaelic reiti and reata denotes a riding horse. The ultimate ancestor of the Dalriartans in both the Sentius and the Four Principal Kindreds is called Eochade, a Gaelic name which is cognate with Epidae. So this would seem to suggest a common heritage that comes from the Britons rather than the Gaels, and for cultural continuity throughout the Roman period. Huh, interesting. However, before we get carried away and declare that this Irish connection is all stuff and nonsense, that actually the Scots went to Ireland first before then coming back, we have to remember that, oh, hang on a moment, rather than speaking a Brittonic Celtic, P-Celtic language, the Dalriartans quite clearly speak a Goidalic Celtic, Q-Celtic. At this point, we remember not to panic, that our doctoral thesis is not blown, a busted flush, and a future in actuarial studies awaits us. Not that this would be a bad thing, obviously, for all you actuaries out there. So, we now remember that in northeastern Ireland, there is a people called the Cruinini. And that name, the Cruinini, actually means Britons. You may remember the foundation myth of the Picts and the brothers of the Cruinni. There is just the possibility that actually Britons travelled to and lived in northeast Ireland, acquired the language of Q-Celtic there, and then many of them migrated back to Argyll. Which brings us full circle, of course. Who knows, who can tell, chalk ices, that sort of thing. Maybe Neil Oliver's graceful, if slightly cowardly, cop-out is the only possible conclusion at this point, namely that what is not in doubt is that northeastern Ireland and Argyll and the Scottish Atlantic seaboard were closely connected and had more to connect them than to divide them. But if all of that explanation has turned your brain to mush, let me summarise. The current thinking is that it is just as likely, and probably more likely, that what happened was that the Brittonic inhabitants of Argyll migrated to northeastern Ireland. There they acquired a new version of the Celtic language from the inhabitants in Ireland. They then migrated back to Argyll to found communities there. Over time, in the 6th and 7th centuries, these communities would acquire a degree of unity in the Kingdom of Dalriata. This means cultural continuity in all but language in the people of Argyll. It means that the Pict who bent Bede's ear was wrong. This had not been Pictish land originally that they had the right to take back if they so wish. I hope this is reasonably clear and that your brain is no longer dribbling out of your ear. So, I think now that most of our peoples at least have joined the stage. We have the Brittonic Picts and Britons. We have the Gaels. There is more to come. The Angles of Bernicia and the Brittonic Kingdom of Strathclyde and its Cumbric language. But we'll let them emerge over time. Next time, we're going to look at the start of another major movement, and indeed one that for some time will define the difference between the Gaels and the Picts, or at least one of those differences. I speak, of course, of Christianity. So that will be in a week's time, honourable members. So in the meantime, have a hoot, a life full of fun and laughter, and we'll meet again next week.